Grab your notes. Let's look at session two. Saturday night, I finished teaching at our Saturday night service and was wanting to work on a couple things. The men's roundtable material being one of them, make sure I was ready for our time together. And so when I was done, I went to a restaurant right down the road on Pelham Road and squeezed into a little hole that I hide in the back, usually late at night. And they know to kind of give me that table, and then they give me the minimal amount of service because they're going to get the minimal amount of tips. So we've worked a deal. And but this gal didn't know our deal, so she came over and she saw my notes and she said, "You grading papers?" And I looked down and I was like, "No, not grading papers." She said, "Well, what are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm preparing a speech." And she said, "What for?" And I said, "Well, it's for some men at our church." And she said, "Well, what's it about?" And I'm thinking, I'm not doing good with all the questions. And she said, "Well, what's it about?" And I said, "It's about masculinity." And she literally took a step back. And I thought, oh, now I am interested. And I said, "Well, here's what I mean, is that it seems to me and to many of us that femininity is more easily understood by women in our culture than masculinity is understood by men. It comes easier to women than it comes to men." She goes, "I totally agree with you, and that is quite intuitive." And I thought, I don't think I know what that means, but I've never been called intuitive before, so I'll take it, right? And so I said, "Thank you, great, fill my glass up, we'll be done." And here's what was interesting, is that if I had wanted to talk, if I had wanted to talk for an hour about this issue, I mean, I had her at hello. I mean, it was straight on. I mean, she was willing to listen to this, talk about this, think about this, wonder about this, and without any background, no work in the myth of Genesis 3, mind you. She's ready to buy in and believe and think and talk and discuss. So let's look, kind of pick up from where we left off last week. And we want to deal with the question of what is a man. And we're going to deal with some future things and we're going to deal with some present things. But we're also going to deal with some historical things, some past things. To review, we studied in Genesis 3. We looked at a story that is larger than life. It happened in space and time. It happened in life, but it's larger than life. And it speaks to us broadly. It's a mountain that we can go back to over and over and mine for truth. It gives us everything from what is a man to what is a woman, the idea of gender that transcends so many aspects of life for us. It just gives insight in so many ways. Let me review real quickly. Here's what we said is the core sin of man. We said passivity is the core sin of man. We talked about the fact that men will vacate a space and then other people will fill that space, particularly a woman will fill that space. And so he will make himself less and less relevant, less and less confident, less and less clear as she becomes more clear, more confident, more strong, stronger, more stable in that role. And so he will abdicate a role and become passive. That's why men are great with the remote control. Can't find a man who's not good with the remote. Give him a remote, that's something he can do, can work that thing. Whether he likes sports or not, good with the remote. Happy to shirk back and even feels relieved when some pressure comes off of him. Well, you don't even have to worry about that. You don't even have to deal with that. And there's a part of a man that just says, "Thank goodness, that's on somebody else now." Here's the second thing we said, that leadership is the core responsibility of a man. Some language, the idea of what does it mean to carry weight? What does it mean for you to carry weight for yourself, but for you to carry weight for other people? So that your life is not a drain on others. Your life is a source of blessing on others. That other people are able to drain from you, which means you got a resource issue that you're going to be giving away and you're going to have to find a way to be replenished, to replenish your tank and to bring strength back to you. But that your life is not about seeking comfort for yourself. You're carrying weight, bringing blessing for other people. It is interesting that if you can talk to women, you can talk to children, but the idea of a man, conceptually, masculinity, a man, manhood, is not a good word in so many circles. That a man is a great source of pain for most of us in the room. For most people in our culture, they can trace great amounts of pain to men. And let me just say it like this, an inordinate balance between men and women. If you said, who has caused more pain in the world, men or women? Most of us in the room start adding up the numbers in our head. We're going to land with more men have caused more pain for us personally and then corporately that we can point to. So it's an interesting idea. When we define manhood, and we'll roll this out more in the coming weeks, but as we define manhood in the present, here's what we mean. Is that we want to reject passivity is the first of the four parts of the definition. We want to reject passivity. We are tempted toward silence. We are tempted toward stillness, towards the quiet, towards a lack of movement. And to be honest with you, the church has reinforced that idea. Is that our churches can be highly feminized. When I say feminized, I don't mean it in a bad sense, because we need full femininity and we need full masculinity. But it is funny how most churches, the environment that is created, if you just left it to a group of men to decorate a building, not that it would really get decorated, but that's part of my point, is that it is not an environment that he walks in and feels comfortable or feels at home. Sometimes the kinds of songs, particularly the more modern songs, sometimes I feel awkward singing the song. Like Jesus is my boyfriend. I'm supposed to hug him and rub my hand through his beard, and we're getting too close. It's just a little weird sometimes. And so we have feminized songs and feminized environments. And like I said, we need the full feminine expression in our faith. God created women. They represent just a significant part of who God is. But it's funny how our religious settings have lost so much of the masculine part of that. And so even our churches emphasize a man sit back, be quiet. Women in the church I grew up in, women lead, women pray, women handle everything. Men barely attend. Men do not play any significant role in the spiritual environment. My dad was the only person I saw ever do anything spiritual growing up. When I got to college and I saw another man named Keith Loughton lead in a Christian organization, it was the second time I had seen a man lead like that. I was blown away. To this day, he is a hero of mine. And so I had never seen anything like it. Not just that, we need to accept responsibility. Where we as men are not seeking comfort for ourselves and we're not seeking privilege for ourselves. We're accepting responsibility for who we are and for all that is around us that we can bring blessing to. So for one man, I watched a couple years ago his family go through a crisis. In the middle of that crisis, I watched him take his children and pull his children close to him. I watched him draw his wife to himself and bring stability to his family and begin to do research and begin to make contacts and network to help navigate his family. And he didn't sleep for a week. I mean, he literally probably slept 10 hours in a week. As he grabbed his family, pulled them close, and did everything that had to be done to bring stability to a really difficult situation. And I was humbled to be able to watch it and watch it from behind the scenes and think, now that is what a man is. I don't know if he can hunt. I don't care if he can fish. I don't know if he knows about art, music, if he's really smart. None of that really matters. What he's doing is pure masculinity to me. And I think I can make it measure with the scriptures. In converse, I'm working with a guy a number of months ago. We were in a setting where we were together for a few days. And I heard his responses to some questions that he was asked. And one night we were up late and he goes, hey, would you give me some insight about myself? Would you, which is a great privilege to be asked as an older guy to be able to say, hey, could you give me some help? And I said, let me ask you a question. I said, tell me about this. And I asked about some college and major and job and some of that stuff. And to all three of the questions, he said, well, that's not really what I want to do, but I'm signing up for this, and that's not really where I want to go, and that's not really what I'm trying to do, but that's what I've got to do right now, and you know, just everything was kind of not. And I said, here's where I want to help you. I said, bro, you're being passive right now. I said, you're distancing yourself from your own life. I said, I've heard you answer that question, which is why I asked you that again. I said, instead of saying, I mean, this is my major, but that's probably not what I'm going to do, say, this is my major, this is what I'm doing. If God redirects me, or this is my path for how I'm getting here, I said, you speak only in negative terms. I said, here's what you're doing. You're playing it safe. You're trying to guard yourself from failure. You're worried that if you tell everybody, here's what I'm going to do, that if it doesn't wind up doing that, you're going to look like a failure. You're playing it safe for yourself. You're distancing yourself from your own ideas and your own dreams. I said, you got to be willing to just lay it down and go, this is what I'm going to go do. And you know what? It may not go well. But to accept responsibility, at least for your own life, then to lead courageously. When it's dark, when you're afraid, when it's not clear, when there are no guarantees, and you see it most clearly when a young single guy comes and asks you and he says, hey, I got this girl I'm dating, I'm really in love, and so I just need you to help me figure out if she's the one. And I just say to him, it's controversial and it's arguable, I hear you, but I say to him, try not to bring pagan mysticism into your relationships, especially if it's Christian. Is that here's what we're doing. We've created the idea of the one so that we can relieve ourselves of responsibility. Jesus doesn't say you have to marry the one. He says you have to marry the kind, and you get to pick. And the idea of saying there's just one person on the earth, hope she didn't get killed in a climbing accident, because then everybody's going to be thrown off, right? But there's not just one person on the earth that you can marry. There's a kind of person that God wants you to marry, and you get to choose, and you get to shoulder the responsibility. If you don't choose well, there are negative consequences. And if you do choose well, there are good consequences. And even when there are good consequences, you choose well, there's still no guarantees of how this thing's going to go. And 10 years down the road, a lot of the responsibility of how the relationship goes is going to be on you. It ain't going to be about a mystical idea of the one. All right? You say, God's hand's going to be in it. He's sovereign. Absolutely. Absolutely. But there are no guarantees. We have to lead even when it's confusing and unclear, and it will be what we make it. And then lastly, to expect God's reward. To learn how to deny ourselves. To learn how to deny ourselves, give ourselves away, knowing that I can be paid back, I can be restored. And so when my oldest child got diabetes at 6 years old, it created about a year-long crisis in my family. It was really painful. And I was walking with a guy at a fundraiser for diabetes, and we were walking. And he said, how's it going? I was like, you know, it's not really going well. And I was explaining it to him just how painful the whole process had been. And he said, but here's the good part of it. And I said, yeah, why don't you tell me that? Because what we were doing is, we're having to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, midnight. My wife's checking her blood sugar because she's just little and sugar goes up and down. You can die in the night. And then I'm getting up at 3, which is fine for a few weeks. But after like 8 months of that, you're really tired. It takes years off the end of your life. We're really tired. He goes, well, here's the thing. He goes, so many men in the world have no idea what they're supposed to give their lives for. He goes, and you know. He goes, you're supposed to give your life for your daughter. And for the first time, I felt some real peace. And I thought, okay, I can live with that. I was put here to die anyway. And very few people get to really figure out what to give their life away for. And I actually have something. So here's what we're going to do. That's our definition. We're going to be working from as we move. But what we need to do is we need to deal some with the past. All right? And we're going to talk about some wounds over the next few weeks. And here's what I mean by wound. When I say wound, here's what we mean. Here's a great word, the word deficit. Okay? We're not talking about psychobabble. We're not talking about removing blame. Let's ruminate on this word. Is that we got some wounds that we want to talk about, and by those we mean a deficit. It's a place of pain. It's something that is missing. Maybe it's a mentality or an action that was inflicted on us. Something that impacts you. And it's easy to say something from the past doesn't impact me now, but that would be foolishness. So for the guy who comes and sits with me and says, you know, I mean, I'm just really struggling, trying to put together my life and my dad. And he starts talking about his dad was a pastor and he has great wounds from his dad growing up because he would be playing at a baseball game. He's a really great baseball player and he'd be in these huge games and his dad would choose to go do something with the church or with another kid in the church and miss his son's baseball game because he was serving in the church. So great wounds towards church, frustrated feelings towards God, real frustration towards his dad, big wounds, big wounds, big wounds. And he was this great baseball player, but his dad didn't really see it. I mean, it just melted down. He's crying, crying, crying. We talked for a couple of hours. A lot of legitimate things there. I mean, a lot of legitimate things. And then as we talk some more, kind of learn, pull some things out, see what's going on in his life right now, come to find out, he's playing on 3 different softball teams. He's playing softball 3 nights a week and leaving his kids at home. And I said, hey, bud, can I let you in on something? This deal with your dad, you're so carrying that, still trying to prove that you're a great athlete. It's like that you're doing the same thing to your children that your dad did to you, which is create all this chaos. I said, if you don't get some peace around, some healing around this idea from your past, you're going to pass on a wound to the next generation. The very thing that has devastated you, you're actually doing to your children now. There are some things that we have to be able to think about because it really does make a difference. Interesting, Proverbs 17:6, the second part of that verse, in kind of your more literal translations, it says, "The glory of sons is their fathers." The Hebrew word for glory means weight. It means to add weight. When you glorify God, you add weight to Him in someone else's eyes. You draw attention to Him. You glorify Him. You bring weight to Him. And here's what dads do. Dads give weight to their sons. And when they don't, then there is a shallowness. There is a lostness. There is a weakness there that's hard to deal with. It's got to be dealt with very carefully. So we got to deal with it. Because dads have special powers in the lives of their sons, in all their children, but especially their sons. So when I grew up, we'd work together. My dad had a construction company and a store. And so I was in a number of different environments. And so we'd be on the job site and go get something to drink. And so we'd go, and my dad only drank Pepsi. And so I would see him push the button, he'd get a Pepsi. So I put my money in, push a button, I get a Pepsi. And sometimes we'd be at a different kind of event. We wouldn't be at work, and he'd be drinking a Pepsi, and I'd be drinking a Pepsi. And there'd be some kids my age over there hanging out, and they would be drinking grape soda or orange soda. And I would say to my dad, "Look at those little kids over there drinking their grape soda and their orange soda. Little kids. They don't drink Pepsi like we do, Dad." I bet I was 25 years old before I drank orange soda. I just like, no. Little kids do that. And then I've experienced it on the other end. Cutting grass. My son's following behind me when he was a little fella. Cutting grass. He's pushing a little plastic lawnmower. Cutting grass too. Go inside. Stand in the kitchen. I'm all dirty from cutting grass. My wife's standing there. Little Micah comes standing up. We're just talking. He leans over and goes, on the kitchen floor. She goes, "What are we doing? What is that? What happened?" I was like, "I don't know. He just spit inside. I don't know what that is." She goes, "No, he's imitating you. Because I don't know what that is. When I walk outside, I start spitting. I don't know. When I walk up to a urinal, I start spitting. I don't know what that is. I don't know why I do that. I have no idea. But I get outside, I can't stop. I spit all the time." I was like, "That's weird, spitting inside." She goes, "He's imitating you." I was like, "That's awesome." Spitting inside. We'll work on that. Robert Bly talks about the emotional connection or disconnection that happens between a father and a son. And it worked well for hundreds and hundreds of years, thousands of years, because a man and his son are working together on a farm, and there is some kind of mystical, emotional transfer of life and energy and knowledge and power and strength back and forth as they work together on the farm. But the Industrial Revolution, when the family is broken apart and man goes to work in a factory all day and son goes to school, and we're not saying any of that's bad. That's just the progress of what's happened. Is there something there that is lost where they are not spending 8, 10, 12, 16 hours a day together, and things that we don't know how to talk about, that we don't know how to teach, things that are just transferred emotionally or mystically, those things just happen. And there's no way to make those things happen. They just happen in the course of time together. And so life off the farm has cost us something. A son learns how to worship from his dad, the emotional piece, and to be okay with that vulnerability and that emotive piece. He learns how to work, how to be diligent, how to endure when it's not going well from his dad. He learns how to tie a tie from his dad. He learns how to ask a girl out. That vulnerable moment where you have to put it on the line and say, "Here's what I want." So there's a lot of work here to do. We'll talk in just a minute about what different aspects of this wound can look like, just speculating. Let me introduce you real quickly to a picture of my dad. I'll give you a little bit of background that kind of explains a little bit about me. I think we have a slide for this. My dad is 25 years old right there. He is just home from Vietnam, all right? And so he is processing that real well at this time. That becomes a much bigger deal later. And there's something, as we look at the picture, there's something really important about that, that a few years ago dawned on me as I had this in my office. We're in Florida on a vacation. I'm not real aware of much of what's going on, but his hands are on me. And that's true. And I got great, intense experiences together with his hands on me. But something about his face turned away is also appropriate. Hard for where he comes from, hard for us to connect in some ways. So it's complicated. Hands are on me, and head is turned away. And he would never want that. His life's complicated. Let me just tell you, I said he's just gotten back from Vietnam, his first moment in Vietnam. He steps off a plane, and one of our planes going down the runway to take off, propeller comes off, goes through the fuselage, and just rips that plane apart. That's his first experience in Vietnam. A year later, he comes home, and he's processing all that. He's grown up in a family of sharecroppers. First person to ever go to college in his family. His dad leaves when he's 4 years old. His mom remarries when he is 6 years old. And it's not until about the time that picture is taken that he will even speak to his stepdad and even acknowledge his presence in the room because he is that bitter. And so it's the presence of me being born where it finally dawns on him, this is what a dad is and this is what a son is. And my stepdad, who I've hated all these years, actually is my dad. And so I got to see that relationship be repaired and even play a role in that, and that was really great. But here, needless to say, here's a man who is completely ill-equipped for the surprise of a new son. This was not what he was planning on, not what he's thinking about, and he is not ready for this. Let me give you three words. I heard Robert Lewis do this, who created most of this material years ago. Let me give you three words to describe my dad. And when we go to group in just a little bit, I want you to do the same thing. That question won't be in your series of questions, but maybe you take a moment and you think through it a little bit. A few words here. And we're going to be careful because we want to be honoring, yet we want to be honest. The first one is strong. My dad is strong. Before he transferred to the University of South Carolina, he was a two-sport athlete in college. Played baseball and basketball. The only person to have his jersey retired at the high school that I went to. He lost about 25 pounds my freshman year in high school, and he was 40-something and dunked in my backyard. So my friends at high school were like, your dad dunks. I was like, apparently he does. That's hard when your dad dunks on you. I'm just saying, right? My son never has to worry about that because I love him so much. He was a teacher and a coach and started a couple businesses and for a certain season would work 50, 70, 80 days in a row. Work all week, teaching school, and then all weekend, traveling with a construction company, getting that started. And just his ability to endure was really, really impressive. And so that translated into all kinds of energy between us. The experiment with his strength, we wrestled and we fought. And we raced, and so there were two paths home from our hardware store. One was a dirt road that was shorter and harder. One was asphalt that was faster, and we would race. And there were days when I would think, if we get to the merge at the same time, I know for a fact he's not going to back down. And what am I going to do? And then I think to myself, I'm going to wreck his truck. Both of his cars will be wrecked. And that was so much fun for us to race home and wonder, how will this day end with Crazy Dad, right? I mean, there was always this kind of adventure on the way. The second word is that he was angry. And the best way I know how to put it is when there are questions around your relationship with your mother that are really, really painful. The deep psychological wound there is if you feel like the one who brought you into this world doesn't really love you, doesn't really care about you, and abuses you, it's hard to think that anybody's going to love you. And that will put, in my perspective, a deep-rooted anger in somebody. And I saw him get mad on a job site one day and throw a hammer so far across the road, I thought, man, I'm so glad I'm not that hammer. I drove up in the driveway one day, and he had a weed eater by the head, and he was swinging up over, and he was bringing it down, and the engine was hitting the asphalt and bursting into 1,000 pieces. And when I got out of the car, there was just a few wires hanging as I got to watch him do that. And I walked up, and I was like, what's going on? He's like, weed eater wouldn't start. I said, you know, if you had just left it there, I'd have just taken it to the dump for you. I'd go get you another one. He goes, no, because if you go throw that in the dump the way it is, some idiot will come crawling through the dumpster and he'll pull it out and he'll take it home and he'll do one little thing to it and it'll work. And in this world, if you don't work for me, you don't work for anybody. So clean this stuff up and take it to the dump now. Yes, sir. I got that. Right? That creates some scary, difficult moments growing up. And then the third word is there is the positive side of it is adventurous slash unsettled. A tremendous amount of energy for adventure, but also very unsettled. He had a knack for going into a community, noticing what's missing, and creating a business, not because he cares about that business, but because he cares about the opportunity to start that business. I literally would drive up to my house after school, and there would be a rental car in the driveway, and I would walk in, and I would look at my sister, and I would say, what are we doing? And she would say, we are leaving and going on a vacation. I was like, now? She said, right now. So I go to my mom, I'm like, what are we doing? She goes, you have about 15 minutes to pack your stuff. And so 15 minutes heads up for a whole week's vacation that nobody knows anything about. It's just on. Just where are we going? I'll let you know when we get there. We're headed south. All right. That also brought an unsettledness about clarity, about who we are, where we're going, what we're doing. A lot of changing tides, a lot of changing directions. And when it came time to figure out, am I pleasing Dad? Very, very difficult, very unclear, very challenging. All that, I was trained and equipped in so many ways. My first three jobs I got, not because I could do anything, but because I quoted what he told me to say. Not for that job, but from years earlier. I was asked a question. He said, if you ever get asked this question, here's the answer to the question. They said, here's a question. I was like, okay. They asked me the question. I go back on mine. This is what does it this. Later on, I said, they said, you want to know how you got the job? Yes. You said this in the interview. I'm like, oh, that's really good. Three times that happened. In other areas of life, not so equipped. When it comes to meeting my wife, relationships, engaging in leadership opportunities, sensitive and emotional people, I was not at all ready for that, right? Let me give you six examples of how the father wound can flesh itself out and some of the consequences. The first one is this. Absent dad. Absent dad can come about either by death or divorce. All right? And so we have a number of folks in our congregation who lost their dad early, or there was a divorce, and so they live in different cities, and it makes life really, really challenging. And so for one guy I know who lost his dad early, he never really gets comfortable in his own skin. He never really gets clear, and he always really struggles to connect in the moment and be comfortable with who he is because he didn't have someone pouring into him on that level. Versus another guy that I know who lost his dad early, who was taken in by some men, particularly another one, and that guy took him hunting because that's what he knew how to do. He knew how to go hunting. And so he took him hunting. They ate breakfast together. Didn't have to be hunting, could be anything. There was some connection there that helped shape this young man. And I can see the difference in the two lives. You can see a certain level of confidence and clarity and just a settledness about life. So obviously, is this anybody's fault? No. A man can't help it that he passes away. A son can't help it that there's that void in his life. But it's real nonetheless and needs to be dealt with. The second one, a neglecting or disconnected dad. Robert Lewis tells the story of being in junior high and lining up for football practice on the first day, and they're giving out helmets and shoulder pads, and they're giving out pants, and everybody's standing there in a line, and he looks down and he notices that he does not have cleats, and everybody else has cleats. But his dad was an alcoholic, completely disconnected, disengaged. And so everybody else's dad has thought, you're going to need cleats for this. But how's Robert going to know that as a 13-year-old, that he's going to need cleats? There's no way for a young man to know that. So in that moment, he feels ill-prepared and ill-equipped, and something as simple as a practical pair of shoes communicates to him that dad is here, he is engaged, he is with me. And without that, you feel exposed, you feel vulnerable, and even angry. Even angry that you feel like a fool because everybody else is ready for something that you're not ready. Everybody else has been equipped, but you haven't been equipped and you've been left out. The third one is a domineering or controlling dad. He maintains control and high energy over, and this can create a couple different scenarios, more than a couple, but two big ones. You can reject all that control and all that management and all that oppression. You can feel it as oppressive and you can become very rebellious. You become the frat boy. And you're going to show that I don't have to live under those rules and I'm not doing that. Here's how I'm going to go live. Do what I want to do. This is what I want to do. How I'm going to do it. Or that energy can be internalized and that young man can become immobile. He can feel inadequate. My dad was really powerful. My dad could control and he could dominate. And I wasn't ever allowed to make any decisions because I'm not adequate to make those decisions. I'm not good enough to make those decisions, but he is. And so he just becomes frozen in a lack of confidence, cannot move. And so absent dad, neglecting dad, domineering dad. Fourth one, performance dad. Performance dad says the grades have to be here. And the sports have to be here. You have to be able to perform at this level, which can create a tremendous amount of pressure on a young man. And he can feel like he can never measure up. Always working. He goes into his adult life, always working, always striving, wanting to know if dad will be happy. He becomes a workaholic, trying to show, trying to perform, trying to prove, trying to measure up. Or, with performance dad, you can just reject that. And you can reject it as a whole generation and create something called Woodstock or hippies who will just say that materialism, all that selfishness, all that pride, we just cast all of that off. All that performance, we just let all that go. Hyper-organic, hyper-relational, we just check out. That's performance dad. Abusive dad, number five. There's something very, very broken inside of him. And for some guys, they can internalize that. And I grew up with a guy like this. He internalized all that anger, and his dad was so angry. He internalized that anger, and he didn't know what to do with it. And it made it so hard for him to relate to other people and not be angry all the time because he always felt like something was real broken in him. There was not any affirmation there. It was this constant weight, constant abuse. And you internalize that, and you don't know what to do with it. And so I would see his anger just come out all the time. Or it just crushes your spirit. Abusive dad makes you feel worthless. You have no value and your spirit is crushed. Number six, last one. You have friend dad. Friend dad, a little bit like hippie dad. He does not lead. He does not equip. He struggles to exert his authority over his son because he does not want to go on the hook. Now, he can frame it as, I want to give freedom. And he can say, I was oppressed, so I want to give freedom. But at the end of the day, it's all about authority and not wanting to exert that authority in a way that puts him on the hook. And so he will become passive and abdicate his role with his son. And in doing so, will not become an anchor for his son. Because especially as our sons get older, they don't have to agree on everything. And they're going to do some things a little differently as they get older. They're going to go in a different direction. But at least they have a point in time and space, an anchor that they can move from. And they can at least go, okay, I'm clear about that. I'm not exactly going to do that. I'm going to do this. But at least I know what that is. And for one guy I know, his dad was friend dad. Not an authority, leader dad, bringing blessing. But here's what it did. And the son explained this in fascinating terms. He goes, I just knew that I was in charge. I was 15 and I was in charge. And here's the thing. He goes, I knew I wasn't supposed to be in charge. I don't know enough to be in charge. I'm not strong enough or powerful enough to be in charge. I'm the last person who should be in charge. And it's very disconcerting when you go to bed at night and you're worried, I'm the one in charge. And I know good and well, I should not be in charge. That is very disconcerting for a young man. So one of these might be you. That's why we don't have to explain them a ton, because you kind of see it, you're like, yes, that's me. Or, that's not really me. I know exactly what this is. Or even if the definition that you sense and feel is a little different, you get that. You see what it is. You're like, well, mine's not really that, but mine's this. My dad wasn't this, but he was this way. But there's enough diversity here to go, you know what? Any and all of these deficits can be for any of us. And how they manifest themselves in us is going to be related not to the wound as much, but as to the personality that you have. So this wound on this personality looks like this. This wound on this personality looks like this. They may go in very, very different directions. So let me encourage you with this. Three options for moving forward. The first one is this. Is that we can live in denial. That we have a wound. We can say, I'm not going to touch that responsibly. I'm not going to deal with it. And you can stay, you can keep your blind spot in place and let it get bigger as you get older, is what will happen. You live in denial, say, oh, not really a big deal, just put that over here. Not a big deal, that doesn't matter, has no bearing on today. And the blind spot just gets bigger and things get worse as you get older. Second way to do it is become a victim. A victim that's full of entitlement. That does not have to accept responsibility, that's going to share this wound with the next generation, and that's never going to fully experience authentic manhood and begin to own their deal and bring real healing and real restoration and become a model for other folks of what does it mean for the life of Jesus to move into us and bring about restoration, redemption, and healing. So we can be in denial, we can be a victim, or a third one, we can look at it redemptively. We can move towards redemption in our wounds. Not just the father wound, but all of them. We can recognize that God is sovereign. You go, well, did God want me wounded? Not exactly. Those are choices that people made. But God is sovereign, and He has a redemptive plan, and He's taken evil and wounds and difficulties far worse than yours, and has brought people through that and brought redemption out of those situations. You go, well, that's hard to believe. I hear you. Especially from where some of you are coming from. Where even reading the word Father in the Scriptures is disturbing to you. As I heard one author, or read one author recently, he said, I think it's a mistake. I think that God should not have called Himself Father. That's kind of odd to me that He would do that, knowing how many bad fathers there are. Or you could think of it this way, is that the fact that that hurts so much shows you that the human father was supposed to be an illustration of a heavenly father. That it's a powerful idea and a powerful reality, and God's not in the business of making mistakes. He knows exactly what He's doing. He knows exactly what He's created. And so the death of Jesus frees you from the bondage of the pain that has been inflicted on you as He teaches you how to forgive. And then He moves through His Spirit into your soul and gives new life. So we have some unfinished business, and we have some time to unpack. And here's what we'll do. The healing side of this we'll deal with next week. That's in the next session, okay? At this moment, what we just want to do, I want to create an opportunity where you go to groups and you just marinate. And you talk about the reality of that the relationship of father-son is a powerful one. Because the relationship of God the Father to His children is a powerful one. And so there may be a moment in your group when you just look at each other. And there's nothing to say and there's nothing to move on. It just kind of is what it is. You just kind of let that marinate on you and experience it for what it is. And so I learned a long time ago, I have 5 kids. And their toys breed and multiply at night. And I used to try to get up in the middle of the night. I'm like, I can see, my eyes adjust, I'm young, I'm in my 20s, I can see. And I would try to walk through the house if something was going on at night. And I've broken 2 toes, and I've fallen, and I've tripped. So now I'm an old guy. I just walk over and turn on the light. Just let me see the chaos, and I'll walk around it. I'll figure out a way to get back to sleep later. Here's what I'm saying. Is that part of the work of a man is to pull back the door of your soul and turn on the light. And some of you are terrified. And I would say, yes, you are. That didn't change anything. That's what we're doing. Lead courageously. You're going to be alone. A little scary. That's fine. Turn on the light and let's just deal. Let's just see what it is. We've been hiding a long time. Hiding and really working for us. Let's try something else. Let's find a different way to move. Rather than just kind of hiding and playing it safe, covering ourselves. Let's try something different. We can always go back to hiding, right? We can always do that. Let's pray. Father, we do ask that there's something about this moment where we get to gather as men and ask hard questions, that we're asking you to speak into it too. We're asking that we would not just do this out of human effort, but that your Spirit would be in us and would be for us, and we could feel a lack of condemnation. We could feel the fact that there is nothing, Romans 8, that can separate us from the love that you have for us, that you are drawing us close, you are making it safe, is that you have always known what was broken, and you have always been wanting to redeem that. And so, Father, would we give ourselves to you fully now? Would you give us environments where we can trust you, where we can trust each other, and we can move towards you, and we can be honest about what's going on in our souls. Give us the language, give us some words, and give us the grace to move. We ask it in your name. Amen.